I certainly think that there's been technology trends in the past that have come and gone, but I do think that AI is certainly here to stay. I do think that vibe coding kind of has its time and place. I think it's really good for building an early proof of concept from scratch. I think it's really good at building something rudimentary. And so certainly it's good at certain things. I think with some of the work that we're doing, where we'll come in and, for example, inherit a very large code base that may be a little bit older and we're maintaining and supporting and updating that for a client, it's not going to be a good use case there. Like I mentioned, some of the big verticals we work in with fintech and healthcare, there's certainly some security concerns with that. And so there's certainly some good use cases for vibe coding. That's not something that we do.
Welcome to How I Grew This, where we dive into the world of digital marketing and connect with leaders in the space about how they're scaling, evolving, and growing. Hey, it's Amanda. Before we dive in, I want to set the stage for today's episode with Robert Armstrong. He's co-founder and CEO of AppStim and started this whole thing back when the App Store was brand new. In this episode, Robert talked about landing his first big clients through cold calls, what he wishes he'd done differently on the marketing side, and the lessons he's learned about building the right team along the way. We also touched a bit on his take on AI, when it's actually helpful and when it's not, and how much more there is to a successful app launch than just having the right features. And he has shepherded a lot of those. For me, it was a reminder that growing something that lasts takes way more than just a good idea. It's about the people, the timing, and the way you bring it all together. So let's get into the conversation with Adam and Robert.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest episode of How I Grew This. This week, I am especially excited to introduce a friend of mine, Robert Armstrong, CEO and co-founder of AppStim, a mobile app agency. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, we've expanded quite a bit. Now we call it a digital product agency, but that was definitely the bread and butter.
Give us the elevator pitch.
Yeah, that we're a digital product studio that creates digital products, and it's all encompassing of custom software, mobile applications, web applications, kiosk applications, AI applications. It's expanded, but certainly that was the beginning, was mobile apps.
Mobile apps. Where I want to start is the beginning, because I have the luxury of knowing you for coming on 20 years-ish, which is scary. And I can say how bonkers it was in our mid-20s to be both, we were both working at Oracle on the sales floor, how bonkers it was to think, okay, my next step is to go off and start something on my own. Like, it just was completely out of the ordinary, and no one else that I knew did that. So walk us through that. How old were you? What were you thinking? Tell us a little bit about our time at Oracle and then how you started AppStim.
Yeah, I mean, I think Oracle was a great proving ground, learning ground. It was a great foundation to be in technology sales, right place, right time. And the thought process was, we were coming out of the 2008 housing crisis. So we had some good years at Oracle and then definitely had a down year. Oracle was looking to restructure and having layoffs. And in the beginning, I was really into it. My father worked in software sales, so I really enjoyed it. But I think that was like a wake up, like, hey, listen, you could get let go and you're really into this and nothing's for sure. And then I had like a fateful dinner with an old college buddy in San Francisco, and he proposed this idea of creating a consultancy. And so I was 29 at the time. I was looking to leave Oracle because of that. And so I was interviewing at a lot of the large, big software companies, and I was married. I didn't have any kids. And so it was a good time to take a risk and try something, knowing it wasn't going to be a guarantee. And my thought process was, if it didn't work out and it failed, that I would just go and interview with these companies I was already interviewing with, and I could try something. And if it didn't work out, I could go get another job. And so it seemed low risk at the time.
In hindsight, it was probably a little higher risk than I thought, but it worked out all right.
So you'd do it again if given the chance.
I would do it again for sure. Concerns of starting a company would be different. It's funny to think back of what my concerns were. Can we get customers? Can we sustain this? Can we grow? Can we hire the right people? Like, I don't know if they would be my same concerns. There'd be a lot of different other nuances to that, which is probably relevant to growth and marketing and things like this that I didn't focus on. I thought that going in and doing sales and building a team, that was a focus. And I think I would focus a lot more on marketing, which isn't something that we had done in the early days and is one of the larger regrets.
We'll get to regrets, but I want to go back to that.
Sure, I got a lot of those.
I'm sure not. Like, running the company for as long as you have, it obviously wasn't that bad of a decision. So you're 29, you're working selling software to big enterprises. You're like, I'm going to go start a company, have a fateful dinner. Why apps? I mean, this was back in, I don't want to age us too much, but this is like the beginning of the iPhone. Like,
It was the very beginning. They released the iPhone in 2007. It wasn't open to third-party developers at the time. You got an iPhone and those apps that came on the phone, MySpace, Facebook, you're stuck with those. Software engineers gave Apple pressure to say, hey, we want apps on the iPhone. This is phenomenal. And so in the following year, Apple released, I want to say October of 2008, released the iOS SDK, the ability to have third-party developers develop apps for the iPhone, which created the iTunes App Store. And so that was in 2008. And if you think back at this point, that's the beginning of the App Store. There's no iPad. In the early days, BlackBerry apps were in demand. Windows apps, it's funny to think, was a very different landscape back then. And then so iPhone was taken off and they opened that up and we saw an opportunity that large companies and really enterprises of all kinds, startups and enterprises would want and need a consultancy that specialized in this, understanding Apple's human interface guidelines, understanding the interface, understanding the integrations, the different form factors. And so that was our focus, was all mobile apps all the time for probably the first 3-4 years of AppSim. That's all we did. We saw web development as a very competitive market. And so we would turn down. We do more web development today than we do mobile apps. But back then we would turn down that work. We thought there was too many players in the space.
So it was impacted. So you came out during the explosion of mobile apps. And you were mentioning you were worried about getting customers. Tell us about your first customer. How did you find and sell your first customer?
It's an interesting story. So when I had left Oracle that day, I'd flown out to Hawaii to meet up with a friend. And the idea was we were going to take a week off to kind of relax and get some rest, you know, working 5 years at Oracle and then going into starting this venture. And so when we went there, we would go to the gym next to the hotel and work out every morning. And it kind of stood out to me next to the check-in. They had a little banner that said, download the new 24-hour fitness mobile app. And so when I had went back at Oracle, it was very specific. I had a specific territory, specific accounts that I could call on. And then to go territory plan for this new company, was the sky was the limit. I could reach out to anyone. And so that had stood out to me at Gold's Gym. And so long story short, I had picked up the phone and cold called the president of Gold's Gym. And you know, I had a very rudimentary pitch, but essentially said, I saw that your competitor, 24-Hour Fitness, had just launched a mobile app and wanted to see if it was something that was on their roadmap. And he said, yeah, it is something we're talking about. And I explained that this is something that we focused on. And so he introduced me to their chief marketing officer at the time. And so we worked with Gold's Gym and their agency of record to build the very first Gold's Gym mobile app. And so it was all just, I mean, I think from starting the company and having that deal inked was probably 4, 5, maybe 6 weeks into the company. And it certainly exceeded our expectations. And we were off to the races from there.
Wow, what a story. I love that. I wonder if 24-Hour Fitness knows what they inspired.
I have no clue. But it is worth mentioning that health, wellness, and fitness to this day is still one of our largest verticals. And so we have a large gym client now, not Gold's Gym, but another large gym client. And we still were members of the Health and Fitness Association and go to wellness and fitness shows. And it's certainly a very large bucket for us to this day, all stemming from that.
Yeah, no, I was curious about that. I mean, obviously, AppSim has been around for a long time. So I was curious to learn about the types of customers that you deal with today or the progression of that over the last many years.
Sure. I mean, kind of a large bucket, but healthcare is a very large bucket. Early on, maybe a year or two into AppSim, we did the initial Kaiser Permanente, the Permanente Medical Group, that division. We did their mobile applications for all of their Northern California members that integrated with electronic medical records. So you could email a doctor and see upcoming appointments, refill prescriptions, things like this. And so that was a very large project that we did 2011, 2012. Genentech was another early client. So this very broad kind of health, wellness, fitness has been our largest vertical by a long shot. And since then, we've done a lot of work with UCSF, Cedars-Sinai, Geisinger. So I've worked with a lot of large healthcare systems.
These are gold AAA clients. Like, how did you, a 20-year-old kid starting his first company, get Gold's Gym like 3 weeks in? Like, how did you even have the capabilities to build a mobile app?
It was the very early days. I mean, a lot of it was right time, right place. A lot of people see one of our marquee clients is Tesla Motors, and we worked with Tesla Motors for probably 5-6 years for a long time. The way that we got the Tesla Motors relationship was a non-compete deal because I had interviewed the gentleman that went and worked at Tesla. So before that, before he went and worked at Tesla, he interviewed for a project management role at AppSim. And we were a small company and I was doing the interviews and things like this. And so I guess I made an impression. I remember we chatted with him. He had a phenomenal background. He was a PM at Johnson & Johnson, was a super nice guy. He was into different things. He was living in the city. We're similar age, similar interests. And I told him on the first call, I said, listen, man, I'd love to work with you. I think you'd be great. Your background at Fortune 500 companies, your process, everything sounds great. We're a small company, though. I don't know if we could afford someone like you. And I had an honest conversation with them. And unfortunately, we kind of agreed that we could not afford him, even though we wish we could have. And he ended up getting a job at Tesla Motors, and he had a project to create an iPad application to be used in all the retail stores worldwide. And so because of that one interview that kind of went bad, he remembered me, and I drove down to Palo Alto to Tesla, and we got the job. And it was a massive reference, a massive client for, again, 5-6 years, and all because of an interview that
we couldn't afford him. But I guess I was just upfront with him.
I've had multiple conversations like that. Some of my best work colleagues, people I've known in the industry forever, I basically said, you'd be bored here, or like, we can't afford you, or like, I have a lot of respect for you. Let's find you another position, because it creates this instant camaraderie of like mutual respect. But from a technical standpoint, like, you were software sales, you're not building the apps. Your co-founder knew how to build the app for Gold's Gym. How did you have the technical chops to get these clients?
Yeah. So my partner, Hart Woolery, he's the one that created apps, came up with the name, and I had joined him. I was down in San Diego and I met with him and explained, hey, listen, I do sales. He's a very quiet, introverted guy, very brilliant engineer, but had no interest in doing sales or cold outreach or anything. So it kind of worked up very well that I would focus on getting the clients and the account management and things like this, and he would focus on building out an engineering team to support it. And it grew very organically. We got our first client, as I mentioned, and then we got our second client, and we never took any outside funding. We never took on any debt or anything like this. And so as we brought on more clients, we would build the team around that. And we still do that to this day. And it's always been slow, manageable growth where we can sustain the team. And we've never had any layoffs or anything like this. And just smart, stable growth. This worked out very well for us.
You say sustain. This is the next thing I want to know. You've been doing this for what, 15 years?
Yeah, I'll be 16 in March. So yeah, 15 and a half.
15 and a half years. And you haven't had any layoffs. You didn't take any funding. This is all organic. My question, and have you done this for 10 years and like totally burned out and stressed all the relationships in my life and probably stressed my body out? How do you make it sustainable? How do you do it like every day for 15 years and still show up to call smiling?
The short answer is having a brilliant team. So I've been very fortunate to have a good team around me. So my partner, Hart Woolery, he exited the business in 2014. And so for the last 10, 11 years, I essentially bought him out and then I grew the team. But we were very fortunate to have my CTO, Chris Newhouse, who's absolutely brilliant. I mean, he's been working with me for probably of the 15 and a half years, 13 and a half of them, maybe. Our creative director, who's kind of like head of product and design, Chris Harris, he's been on the team for probably 9+ years. And so we brought on a senior project manager, David, 3-4 years ago. He oversees all delivery and project management. I mean, the one thing is we're a fully US-based team. Pre-pandemic, we had an office in the financial district for many years. We are a remote team now, but all US-based. So I think that's a lot easier to manage versus offshore teams or different time zones and languages and things like this. But I'm very fortunate to have a good team around me. I brought on a pretty senior level sales guy 4-4.5 years ago. He came from a large consultancy, Steve, and he oversees new business and business development and partnerships. So the only way to do this is to have a good team around you. You're not going to be able to do everything. And so I'm very fortunate to have an awesome team that is absolutely brilliant that helps manage things for me.
Well, having a great team is definitely a wonderful strength to have. I'm curious if there's been any evolution in your approach to the types of profiles you hire over the course of this 15 years. Obviously, don't hire anyone you can't afford. That's a good lesson we learned.
Yeah, that's a good one.
But anything else to share about how you approach bringing on great talent today versus in the early days?
The short answer is you're constantly refining this. You're learning from bad hires, you're learning from good hires, but it's a constantly evolving process to be able to interview and vet, particularly software engineers, which isn't necessarily as tangible as a sales guy or something like this. And so I kind of pride ourselves on our interviewing and our vetting process for software engineers. And the reason why I say that, and trust me, we've had some bad hires, but
telling them to close their ears if they were ever
Yeah, I mean, for the most part, I mean, we're batting pretty good. And I think the process that we refined, the way that we vet them, the way that we interview them, we want the interview process for engineers to be very kind of similar to our working practices. It's something where we work remote, you're very autonomous, you have to be resourceful. And so it's very similar to the work-life balance that we have here and the work style we have. And that interview process is to match that. And I think we've done a good job. And the way I feel is that I would put our engineering team against most. And it's a very small, smart, agile, versatile group. And I feel good about it because we've had engineers that have left, have gone to work directly to the Googles, the Apples, the Airbnbs, the you name those big tech companies that are hard to get in. And we've had engineers go to those big tech companies. And so I know we're hiring good talent. And I think that's really our differentiator is the team and the experience and the reputation we have.
If it's not a secret, tell us about that interview process. Do you give them a project? Do you have them deliver?
Yeah. So there's a co-challenge. So it's, again, one of our differentiators to get this top talent. It's not a 6-month long interview that you'd get at a big Fortune 500 tech company. It is 4 steps. And we're looking for a number of things around skill and culture, experience, versatility, things like this. But a big piece of the technical nature of it is a take-home code challenge. We give them 3 days. And it's similar to the types of projects and client work that they would have at AppsThem, but being able to see how they do that. And like many things, there's many different approaches to it. There's optimal ways, there's lazy ways, there's AI ways, but we can tell how they're doing it. And it's a good way to see how they would approach a problem, how they would solve it in software. And then we review it with them and understand their overall thought process and approach and things like this. And it seems to work out pretty well. And we can tell it's a good way to understand technical skills. It's a good way to understand attitude and how they approach it. I mean, we pride ourselves on having a very low ego team. And I think that's very good. So understanding they're willing to do a code challenge is a good kind of attitude test and things like this. And so it works on a number of different cylinders and we continue to refine it. It's essentially a code challenge and a problem they have to solve, and understanding how they solve that is very helpful.
I'm curious too about all of the changes in the world, AI, all the good stuff. So are there variations where you're trying to bring on folks with different skill sets that understand like different languages, or how does that play a role in all of this?
Sure. I mean, certainly we need to have, when folks hire us, that they're going to get a senior level team that is experienced. So we are always hiring for different roles and trends. And I kind of make the joke over the last 15 years that the trends, even in our size of a company, they're very obvious and you can see how trends come and go. And whether it was blockchain a few years ago or social media apps, or I mean, these things come in waves. Certainly AI is extremely popular for us. We're working on a couple AI projects as we speak that are very exciting. And so now, over the last couple, I don't know, year or so, been on a large Python hiring because of the wave of AI. And so that's something that we probably haven't hired for in a while, but now we're bringing AI and ML experience and Python engineers on staff to support that.
I've got a question about the clients. Since the dawn of the mobile app, you've been helping people launch mobile apps. I'm sure some of them have gone great. I'm sure not because of you guys, but the apps have fallen flat. When you're thinking about building an app or building up something that they're bringing to the customers, what do you think in terms of a project that makes it successful? Like, if you were to say to all the people listening today, what should you frame in your mind about bringing a service to market to make it successful?
Sure. I mean, we've worked with, being based in San Francisco, a large number of very early stage startups that are on the friends and family round or pre-seed, and we've helped them launch their initial product to market. And some of these have gone on, like you said, to be acquired for hundreds of millions of dollars was one client that we had. And some have gone on to get acquired, and some have had failure to launch where they didn't really go too far. And so I think a big thing is, especially founders, they get so focused on features and functions, and really they should be focusing on those early customers, the problem they're looking to solve, and really trying to get a product to market that solves that problem. It's software. You could always add more bells and whistles, but they try to really bloat the product in the beginning without user feedback and without having something that's out there in people's hands to be able to iterate on. And so if you get focused on that, it could take longer time to market. It could get very expensive. And so getting something to market, but really focusing on the go-to-market plan, the user acquisition plan, your early customers, how you're going to grow the platform, whether it's a web platform or mobile platform, whatever it is. But being able to focus on customer acquisition is extremely important. And you would be surprised how much that is an afterthought. They go out and raise a certain amount, or they get a budget and they build a product with really no budget left over, or really not much of a go-to-market plan of how they're going to attract those early users. And I think that really needs to be the larger focus, right? If you build the perfect product, how do you get people to know it exists? How do you get people to download it? And there's over 2 million apps in the App Store. How do you get people to download it and use it? Are you going to provide a piece of software that's going to solve something that they're going to go and use this? Is there some utility to it to continue to use that on a daily, weekly, monthly basis? And so that's really, I think, in some cases, at least the ones that struggle, it's been an afterthought. And you could see that early on.
My last call was a pitch session where people were pitching. And I was thinking, like, if I was a VC, I'd have to get really good at being able to identify if someone had their stuff together to release. Do you have a good sense when you're working with someone building an app, whether they're going to succeed or not?
Not in all cases. I kind of make the joke that if someone came to me a decade, 15 years ago, and said that they're going to create a social media app and you have a 140 character limit and we're going to have hashtags and we're going to call it Twitter, with Facebook, I would have thought that sounds like a terrible idea. So shows you what I know. I'm not saying I know all the answers, but I can generally tell that when there is no go-to-market plan, there is no budget for that, no plan for that, that it would be difficult. And we spend a lot of time and a lot of care to build these software products. So where we don't have any equity or skin in the game, it doesn't really matter to us. But when you spend this much time on something and you really think about it, you really think about the interface and the integrations, and you want it to succeed just because, well, you built that and you want to see it do well. And there's some pride in that.
I can't help but notice the parallel to the start of our conversation where you were talking about how you kind of wish you had thought about marketing earlier on. So I guess my question for you is this a lesson that has come through over time? Are you now learning through the interactions with these types of apps? Is this something that you make a part of each conversation when you're bringing on new clients of, hey, here's how you should be thinking about this plan? Talk to me about it.
I mean, I always was on the enterprise sales side of things. So our go-to-market plan was direct sales outreach of cold calls and cold emails. And that was very effective in the beginning and wasn't as crowded of a space. But we got, like I said, early customers with Gold's Gym, with Enterprise Rent-A-Car was a cold call, K&L Wines in San Francisco. So a number of our very early clients were from cold calls. It's just not as scalable, right? There's only so many people you can call. And so I do wish that we brought on marketing expertise in the early days, as it was a bit of a land grab for people to have a mobile app in the app stores. And I think some of our competitors and friends, I guess they're both, that did a good job at that, really kind of scaled their companies. I have a friend and they had 3 SEO people on staff. And I thought, that's crazy. How could you support that? But those companies really scaled and became quite big. And it's something that I regret not doing early on. We do have outside consultants and teams that help us with marketing today around email marketing and trade shows. And so it's something that we certainly focus on now, but we didn't in the early days. And that was certainly a miss. That was a lesson learned. Certainly when we talk to founders that are looking to launch their initial product, I tell them, like, you got to focus on this. And it's not a service that we provide today, but we have partners that we will introduce them to. And certainly if they don't have those expertise in-house, we'll try to make those connections and direct them in that way.
So let's talk a little bit about the future. I am particularly interested in some of the trends that you're seeing or some of the things you believe in or your inside scoop. Like, do you think people are going to just be able to start vibe coding to make their own apps? Or what are we looking at here?
Certainly, this is a question I get probably twice a day. So certainly, AI is extremely popular. I certainly think that there's been technology trends in the past that have come and gone, but I do think that AI is certainly here to stay. I do think that vibe coding kind of has its time and place. I think it's really good for building an early proof of concept from scratch. I think it's really good at building something rudimentary. And so certainly it's good at certain things. I think with some of the work that we're doing, where we'll come in and, for example, inherit a very large code base that may be a little bit older and we're maintaining and supporting and updating that for a client, it's not going to be a good use case there. Like I mentioned, some of the big verticals we work in with fintech and healthcare, there's certainly some security concerns with that. And so there's certainly some good use cases for vibe coding. That's not something that we do. We do use AI internally to help our engineers be more efficient. We looked at this a couple of years ago and standardized on Microsoft Copilot. And so we use that across the board for all of our engineers, again, to help facilitate and speed them up. And that certainly gives us some efficiencies. AI as a whole has certainly brought us a whole new service face or book of business where we're building AI apps for our clients. And so we're working on a number of AI projects right now. And those clients, as the more work we do, the more opportunities they see to be able to provide efficiencies or streamline business operations and things like this. So we're working with the large mortgage company to help them with kind of their underwriting process. And so AI is huge. And it's, again, something that we're continuing to try to hire talented AI and machine learning engineers to the team.
Python or specifically ML?
Python, yeah. Python is extremely popular. And so, yeah, we're looking for a number of Python engineers right now.
FYI, guys, Python engineers, it sounds like you get a job with him, you'll get a job with Google afterwards.
Yeah.
So, hey, Tesla. Okay, so AI today is helping with your workflows. A lot of your clients are using AI. It sounds like they're using AI as a product or service, or at least heavily integrated in their product offering. If you were to do like a forward-looking projection for your business, or let's say even your industry, if you're more comfortable talking about that, what changes, developments, enhancements, opportunities do you see with AI looking ahead?
Yeah, I think OpenAI releasing ChatGPT, was that just over maybe a year and a half ago, where I think really folks saw the capabilities and the opportunity with AI. So that's really kind of like AI's been around for a while, but it was really when ChatGPT, the initial version, was launched to the public that people saw what was possible and they could play with that. And so that's really when things rocket as far as interest. And so I think that AI is, just released the new version of ChatGPT. They'll continue to refine that and it's going to get better and better. And ideally, it'll help our engineers be more efficient and streamline things. I think you're always going to need a software engineer to be able to do that, but they can use these tools to be more efficient. And I think those are going to get better. Yeah. And so certainly those are the opportunities we see, is that you get non-technical people that see the possibilities and they want to be able to have their companies be more efficient, whether they're redundant business practices or operations or streamlining workflows, whatever that may be. We'll have teams that are able to work with them and work within their systems, whether it's ERP systems or their inventory management systems or whatever that is, to be able to automate those workflows and streamline those. So that's where we see the opportunity for AppStem, is to come in and really help drive that strategy, the possibilities, the capabilities, making sure that the data is something that we can use and is formatted in a way to be able to build on top of, whether we're using a system like OpenAI or Claude or Gemini or whatever it is we're using, but doing those integrations and making sure that those AI applications, agents, whatever it may be, that it's successful for them.
So you sound like very additive to your business. It's going to be a wealth of opportunity, not a threat.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the future holds, but today, and I think in the near future, it is providing more business opportunity for us to be able to work with our clients and build out these capabilities. And it has been a boom for our business to be able to do this. And so it's been helping versus putting us out of a job, I suppose.
Unsurprisingly positive outtake from you. You seem like you're pretty positive, just net for the business. Again, I'm going to go back to this 15 years, not burned out, still smiling on the calls to go for it. If you were to talk to yourself 15 and a half years ago, young Robert leaving Oracle, what would you tell yourself? What advice would you tell yourself starting your journey?
I think, like anything, and I encourage a lot of people, I would say go for it, give it a chance. There's a lot of people out there that come to us that have ideas, and I'm always encouraging for people to take a chance, even if they fail. And so what I would say, going back to my earlier point, is to bring in maybe a marketing team early on to help really scale the business. I mean, certainly, I think the company could have been larger at this point had we invested more in marketing early on. That would be the big thing. I think there's some other things around hiring, where early on we began because we were bootstrapped. We didn't have the budget or the ability to pay for some senior level, particularly around project management stuff. And I think we learned a hard lesson around that. And so there's a lot of PMs out there. And I've learned that a good project manager is worth their weight in gold. And so that's another lesson that I tell people, is bring in a senior level PM that really has a good process, good client communication, stuff like that. But yeah, it's just things that, like, even early on, you got to make those mistakes to learn them. It's kind of part of the process and it's the way to learn. But yeah, if you look back, I mean, there's only so much you can read in a book. At a certain point, you got to go try things and learn. And again, I've been very fortunate. And the AppStem team and culture is the big piece of this story. And we're very proud to have a near perfect rating on Glassdoor. Not to say that we haven't had some bad hires and learned how to identify those folks during an interview process, but it's hard when you only have maybe talked to a candidate for a total of 3 to 6 hours before you hire them. And so that's, I think, part of it is you're going to learn and fail, and that's how you learn. And that's maybe the best way to learn sometimes.
So just to read that back to you and tell me where I'm wrong.
Sure.
You'd said the advice you'd give yourself is invest more in marketing earlier and yep. then hire better PMs earlier. Figure out a way to get the budget to hire better PMs earlier because they return their ROIs.
Yeah. And the easy answer was it was a PM coming in and said, listen, you guys are billing me out below industry rate. If I had the foresight to be able to bill out project management at a higher rate, we could have afforded that.
Charge customers more, is that?
Yeah. You guys, I mean, he came in and kind of explained, listen, you guys are billing me out too low. When I was at this previous agency, they were billing me out at almost double. And so that was a small tweak. We never had any pushback. And because the big thing, I don't care what service you're providing, whether it's digital product or software development services or whatever it is really client communication and client expectations is what you're managing. And it's a good PM that's going to be able to provide that.
So if you could wave a magic wand today, looking forward, would you be like all else equal? So like lower margins, larger company, or fatter margins, smaller company? What do you think would be more enjoyable to run?
Me personally, I'd go for the latter. I'd go for a smaller company. And that's always been the focus. Because again, when Hart and I started this, he had worked at a company. He was acquired by AOL, worked at a big company, hated it. I worked at Oracle. I'm not saying I hated Oracle, but I was certainly ready to leave Oracle. I really enjoyed Oracle, but you know, the housing recession and things like that really kind of put a lot of stress on sales guys. And so you could, and I've learned this from a lot of people and had a lot of conversations with other much bigger company owners than myself. And I mean, I could go get more clients today at a smaller margin, and that's certainly not the focus. I think we can provide a much better service and a much less stressful experience to the team by having a small group of clients and being able to service them well. And I think that will serve you well.
All right. So to wrap us up here, you mentioned early on that y'all have shifted your focus from just apps to broader digital. So as I think back to you being one of the earliest people working on apps, if we really think about it, and all of the different eras of apps that you've seen, and now really your decision to shift that focus to digital, what does that mean? And what does the future look like for companies with apps or app-first companies or companies that, you know, it's a sidebar?
The big focus for us is to be able to be where our clients need us and whatever interface that is or wherever their users or consumers are, we want to be there. And so over the last few years, we've seen a big push into touchscreen self-service kiosks. So that's been a big focus for us, creating touchscreen kiosk apps. And so that's a big focus. AI apps, as we've talked about, is a huge focus for us. Certainly, we still do a lot of mobile apps to maintain and support those for our clients and build net new mobile apps. Our software development team is the larger development team at this point doing full-scale web applications. I mean, everything's across the board. So even when we're doing a mobile platform, there's usually some sort of back-end web portal or content management system needed. We're doing a very large telemedicine app right now where the patients or the end user will be using a mobile app, but that team, all of their educators and physicians will be going through a web portal. So everything's cross-functional at this point. So whether we're building an Apple Watch app or an AI app or CarPlay app, an Apple TV app, whatever that interface is that people are going to be using as the end interface, we want to be able to have the team to specialize and support that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on, Robert. It was awesome to hear your story and some lessons learned.
Robert, it was great catching up. Again, congratulations on the business. It's great to see you still smiling out there.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for listening. If you like the show, please leave a review wherever you listen to this and share with someone trying to grow their career or their business. Until next time, keep growing.